Okay, good afternoon, everyone. So this is the promised exam review session. Everyone likes lists of topics. I don't guarantee that this is exhaustive, but this is what I got going through my slides. Schedule. That's big topics. So some note, this is probably the slide modulo having the input string there cut off a little bit that I should have showed you for format string exploits. Though hopefully most of you figured it out. And the biggest confusion I am not also disappointed I didn't address head on is that there's a difference between where things are in the buffer here. So we have a buffer with a number of characters with the format string, which has like percent signs, and we care about the location in the buffer because that's where printf looks for its arguments. That is different than where things are in the output of printf, which is how percent n determines what it's outputting. Like putting this percent 0.92u outputs 92 characters, it doesn't mean that it uses 92 spaces on the stack, which people often got confused when they were tweaking things in the assignments, and in my office hours at least. Okay. So otherwise, so this is my list of topics. I don't know, I'm not gonna just go over all of these because I don't think it's useful to just repeat the lecture in really every lecture really quickly. I assume there's some topics you care more about. So let's assemble, a list of questions. So I'll just take questions and write them down. Okay, yes.
You said return object programming could be done without doing stack overflow. But I was confused about how exactly that was
okay.
Done. Without modifying the stack, it seemed like that's even.
Okay, without stack overflow and implicitly jump programming. Okay. Other questions? I'll just collect all the topics. Yeah.
Using Stack Overflow to manipulate pointers.
Okay. Yes.
Retable overwrites
and ROP. Okay. Okay. Just generally, do you have a more specific thing you're interested in?
Like how it is actually,
Okay. Yeah.
Baggy bounds correctly?
Okay, baggy bounds. Anything specific about it? Just?
Most of it.
Okay. So no. Other topics, questions? I also will take general questions. Yeah.
Just ASLR on Linux specifically have different sections get like different random amounts. Like it's not
ASLR on Linux. Yeah. So ASLR granularity. Let's say Linux. Okay. Other questions, topics. Yeah.
The use after free example, specifically the Chrome.
Okay, I'll need to pull, just the Chrome example specifically, or the idea in general? Use after free, yeah. Okay. Other questions, are we done? I'll probably ask for more later, but I'd like to try to collect and group all these together. Okay, so first topic here is return-oriented programming without Stack Overflow. So there were several flavors of this. So I gave an example of setting up return-oriented programming without necessarily starting on the stack. And usually the technique you would use to do this, the simplest thing to do that is, was that we somehow, we overwrite a function pointer somehow. In this case, there's this lots of indirection, which often happens when you're not, I don't have something that's nice and straightforward as a return address, but we somehow overwrite, replace a function pointer. So in this case, we didn't actually overwrite the original function pointer, but we overwrote a pointer to it, which is the same thing as far as what's going to happen. And we overwrote this to point to our gadget. And our gadget doesn't need to end with a return, is the key idea here. That we have other options. So in this case, our gadget ends with a jump. And all we have to do is make sure that the value that's in RDI is correct. And there's different ways that this might happen. And one thing is that, well, there's a value in RDI, whether it's supposed to be there or not. So we could just look at whatever the code in this function does, how it's the compiler compiled it, and that's probably going to use RDI. And we can just say, what's in RDI? And based on that, we decide whether or not this gadget makes sense or not. In this particular case, of this example, it happens that RDI is where one of the function arguments goes. So that's how we got to choose where we jumped. And I didn't show it to you, but it turns out you can chain these together. Like you can make a sequence of these things that end in jumps that also set something else, maybe on the stack, maybe not, and chain them together without relying on things that end in returns at all. So at no point do we rely on having something on the stack in particular. And we can also use this to set up the stack. So this, for example, pushes something on the stack. So if we have a return later, now it can return to somewhere useful. Assuming, so this makes sense? Confusion? Yeah. So in this example, this is also answering the vtable overwrite example. So when foo is accessed normally, there's a pointer in it, which we use to find a function pointer. So that was the normal access path. That it took foo, we looked at this pointer, we used that pointer to find a pointer to another function. In the case where foo is overwritten, the attacker overwrote foo to point to their own buffer. Just the same sort of idea we have with stack smashing, but this is within an object that's probably on the heap. So point to our own buffer, and we make this vtable pointer, the first thing that we're pointing to, point also back to the buffer again. Just because we know that there's this indirection that's going to happen when this function here tries to call some method. So that points to the buffer again, and at the right place in the buffer where this method would normally look for where to call some method, it finds our pointer to our gadget because we arranged our buffer to have that there. Yeah?
So what would be like the context? How would this be used in an attack exactly?
The question is how would this be used in an attack? So I don't have this button. So this case here is an example of a vulnerable function which gives us a whole attack. So when we set up this gadget correctly, if we set up the values, if we know what the value in RDX and RDI are, and we can set them and control them, which is in this case is actually the case because they're actually x, because RDX is one of the values we control, and RDI is also points to a value we control. So we can control what those values are. So this is our attack. We get to, because of this gadget, we get to run whatever code's at RDI. So if we can make sure that that's useful code with how things are set up, we've successfully done what we want to do. So for example, if we can maybe just jump to something which runs a command based on what's in RDX or RSI, we're done.
So we're not actually overwriting a vtable pointer, we're just making our own pointer, and we think that our pointer is a vtable.
Yeah, so in this example, so we have, so I'll probably switch back. So this is, I guess, vtable overwrites. This is up here. So we're kind of grouping all our return-oriented programming stuff. So vtable overwrites. So we have multiple options. So example, the slides overwrites pointer to vtable pointer. Vtable pointer could also overwrite vtable pointer with different vulnerability. So the vulnerability on the slide doesn't let you overwrite a vtable pointer just because it's not after the buffer. But some other vulnerability might let you do that more directly. And the next step here was that when we overwrote the vtable pointer, we put pointer to a gadget where pointer to method was expected. So the compiled code we had to call some method was looking for a pointer to the method at some location based on the vtable pointer, and we just put a pointer to one of our gadgets there. Instead of that method. And these are, I guess, grouped together. So return-oriented program without Stack Overflow and vtable overwrite is an example. So this is example is a vtable overwrite to do that. Yeah?
So if we were doing it with a Stack Overflow, then we could just overwrite the return address of one vtable?
Yeah, so this is basically replace value pointer in vtable for pointer on stack. Right, so we had a pointer on stack, which was the return address. And we've just replaced that with a pointer in the vtable. Otherwise, the exploit is the same. And usually when you have a pointer in a vtable, or often other exploits that aren't return address based, they're a little more complicated. Because there's usually some indirection to find the function pointer, which doesn't exist with return addresses. Yeah?
I'm a little confused with how vtables have evolved exploits,
essentially. So the question is, how vtables can evolve? Where, like, that they can, or?
How are they generally used in exploits?
So I'll add this as a new topic. So vtables and exploits. So there's a general topic here, which is function pointers and exploits. Cracker control program. So the basic idea is we change a function pointer that the program uses, and that lets us control the program. So vtables have function pointers. Table pointer changes function pointers it points to. So this is a way of changing function pointers. So return addresses are also function pointers. So this is part of this general pattern that we're going to take some sort of function pointer. The easiest example was a return address, but we have other examples like vtable pointers. We had global offset table entries and linker stubs. And there are more in real applications. And just any of them is suitable for the attacker because they're just a way of controlling what the program does. Yeah?
So to perform a return-oriented programming, you don't necessarily need a Stack Overflow, but you need some sort of buffer overflow.
So the question is, to perform return-oriented programming, you don't necessarily need a Stack Overflow, but you need some sort of buffer overflow. So I'll ask everyone here. Can anyone think of an example where you wouldn't need a stack or a buffer overflow of some sort? Yeah.
IDEA is after free.
So use after free is an example where you don't need one. So there's still a you need some sort of memory error, because probably someone, the programmer, did not write code which reads a value and puts it in a function pointer deliberately. So you probably need some sort of memory error, but there are other kinds besides buffer overflows, like a use after free. Yes?
Can you clarify the difference between a buffer overflow and a stack overflow?
So difference between buffer and stack overflow. Okay, I'll get to this later. Buffer and stack overflow. Okay, so other things. So jump oriented programming I listed, which is return oriented programming, but gadgets don't end in return. Right. And we can do that, it's just harder to set up. I didn't go through the details of how you'd make that work. It's possible to do, and it's generally as good as return oriented programming. It's a lot harder because you need to keep careful track of what's in what register, and you can't always put your address to jump to in the same place. You probably, so you have to like switch it around, but it's doable. So you just look at the jump and call instructions at the end of the gadgets, and you keep track of what you're putting in those registers based on what your gadget does. Does it do a move from a memory location to a register? And then there's some other gadget call based on that. You can chain them together that way. Just a lot more work than just return addresses, where you just look for push and pop, which is much easier to systematically find. Okay. So anything else on return-oriented programming? Yes. Okay, so in the example on the slides, how was I manipulating RDI? I didn't want to display my slides anyway. Probably need to do, I think it was here. Probably way over here. I think these are in order. There, okay. So the question is, how are we manipulating RDI? And RDI is the first argument to a function. So the reason we knew what RDI was is because the way this method call is implemented is by looking up this some method pointer, passing foo x and y to it. So we could manipulate RDI because we overwrote the foo pointer. We didn't have like total control over what RDI is, because it's also where the vtable pointer is found. So we can't like set it to an arbitrary location and expect everything to work. But we do know what it is, and it's not what it originally was. And in this case, it was useful because it uses what RDI points to, which happens to be the first entry of our fake V table. So we could actually use that location. Yes? So in this example, so you say we could pass in the new address. So in RDI, we're always passing, RDI points to our buffer in this case. That's the way we set it up. And we don't have that much control over it because where our buffer needs to point to a fake vtable pointer. Because that's going to be how this code here finds some method, what it thinks is some method. But it does also pass that thing it finds, the way it finds it, what it thinks is an object of type bar, or sorry, of type foo, it does pass that to the function itself, because you have a this pointer in a C++ method. So it passes the this pointer, and that's what RDI is. So just like in the legitimate implementation of some method, we might use the this pointer for something, we can also use the this pointer in our SERP gadget. But we can't just put anything there, because it still needs to be sufficiently close to a foo object. And in this case, it needs to have this pointer to what we think is some method set up correctly. Yes?
So this gadget would jump back into the buffer?
So the question is, does this gadget dump back into the buffer? So the answer is no. And that's good, because this exploit will work despite write X or execute. So these dotted lines represent data pointers that are being followed. So foo is overwritten, and the code that we're running reads foo to figure out where to read the vtable pointer, to figure out where to read this pointer. But those are all just reads, not executing anything yet. So after it reads this pointer, then it jumps there. So it never actually jumps to code in our buffer, which is good, because we want to work with write X or execute. This buffer here is going to be mapped non-executable in memory. That's that table that the OS sets up is going to say execute no. Yeah?
So the jump RDI is like the gadget. Is RDI going to be different?
So this is jump to where RDI, this is jump to where RDI points to. Maybe this is not actually a setup this is jump to read a location from based on RDI. Oh yeah, so it probably reads, yeah. I might have, this slide might be wrong for that reason. I thought it was doubly indirect for some reason, and it is not.
It should probably be RSI.
Yeah, we probably should have a gadget which manipulates RxI or something like that. And I'm sorry for this confusing error. Okay, so example also should use RxI instead of RDI, since we can't make star RDI be right. If it was like star RDI comma like 8 RDI or something like that, that would work. So I'm sorry for that confusion. I for some reason thought that jump instruction was doubly indirect, which obviously it isn't. So any other questions on return-oriented programming? Yeah.
Do they always attempt to make it back? Do they let it crash?
So the question is, what do you do after the return-oriented programming thing finishes? So just like with our overflow assignment, that's up to you. Like, do you care about the program crashing? If you don't, you just don't finish and let it crash. It's very common to end with end your exploits with an instruction which, on Unix-like systems, I should say, to end your exploits with an instruction which runs and execute, which runs an executable and gets rid of the current program. So in that case, you clean up correctly. But that's mostly actually because that's more convenient to do than starting the executable in the background. But you have the option to do anything. Like it's complete, so you have the choice of trying to recover and make the program run normally. But it's usually not worth it. Other questions on return-oriented programming? Okay, so Stack Overflow to manipulate pointers. So the setup here is that we might have a stack. This might be what's on our stack. We have our return address, we have a stack canary, and we have some local variable pointer and some other local variable value and a buffer. So if we overflow this buffer, it overwrites pointer and value. So this is the sort of way we might be able to manipulate pointers with a stack overflow. And if the program does something like this, after we overflow the buffer, we get to write any value anywhere. And there's lots of ways we can use that. So, pointer. So we can just make pointer point to data we want to change, just normal data, like a grade. We could make it point to a function pointer. So point pointer to function pointer and make that function pointer change. And there's a bunch of other things we could possibly do. But this is the basic idea of how you might manipulate pointers with a Stack Overflow, that you just depend on there being interesting pointers somewhere in the stack, which is not guaranteed, but often that will happen. And usually it's going to be something like a local variable is stored on the stack. Another possibility is saved value of, you know, RBX, which was used for a pointer, let's say. That might be another thing that's on the stack that you can overwrite. And often, it's not guaranteed, but often the stack will be laid out like this, where you don't overwrite a stack canary when you do it. Yeah.
So for the format string attack, if we had not used format strings, could we have just overwritten the variable value directly by writing down the stack?
So the question is, in the format string assignment, could you have just done stack smashing? And the answer is no, because that program used a function which asked for the length of the buffer to get its input.
So you can't overflow it?
So you cannot overflow the buffer, yes. If it didn't use that function, if it used getAss instead, yes, you could do it. But it was that part of the program was written correctly. So questions about Stack Overflow for manipulating pointers? I guess I note that this also applies to non-Stack Overflows. Okay. So on format string exploits. So
correct screen. So on Stack Overflows, we got.
So what the idea of format string exploits is. So we have a call to printf here, which takes one argument. And printf is going to look for additional arguments based on characters in its first argument. So if you use 4% C's, it says, OK, I know argument one is that string that contains my format. And I know after it, there should be other stuff. Oh, there's 4% C, so I'm going to read argument 2, argument 3, argument 4, argument 5. I'm going to print each of them out as a single character. That's what printf decides when it sees these first 4% C's. And those are arguments 2 through 5 on 64-bit Linux are in registers. Then we have arguments 6, 7, and 8, 0.92U. So it's going to look for 6 in a register again. Then 7, it's going to look on the stack after its return address. That's just what the calling convention says. And how printf, format string exploits usually work is that it happens to be that our buffer is on the stack, which means that the place where something like printf will be looking for its arguments will include our buffer in some way. In this example, our buffer starts right after the return address. If it didn't, this would be slightly different. So it looks for 8 bytes for each argument because we have a 64-bit system. So the 7th argument to printf, which is this last percent C here, is going to be these bytes of the buffer. The 8th argument is going to be these bytes of the buffer, that string as a 64-bit integer. The 9th argument is going to be these bytes of the buffer, which doesn't actually work. So what's going to happen here? So this percent n here is going to use argument 9. So it's going to segfault. So it's going to segfault. That means it's accessing some memory it's not supposed to. What memory that it's not supposed to is it going to be accessing? Yeah, so this value here, whatever that part of the string is, interpreted as a pointer. So it's going to be accessing that and trying to store the number of characters it printed out so far. So if only we add another percent sign, we would end up having printf argument 10, which would be the last part of the buffer. But that's the basic idea of the format string exploit is we're taking advantage of being able to specify a pointer because we control the area of memory where printf is reading its values. Yeah?
So to make this work, we would write our return address into where it says buffer there, the top block, and then add like one more percent C somewhere?
Yes. So the key idea is arg7, arg8, arg9 on stack after return address. Usually with input buffer. So, which means we can specify pointers. 4% n. It keeps going. Sorry, I should say arg9 etc. It keeps going like up to 1,000. And so we have two things. So control two things. So location pointers are red. By number of percents. I should write this. Okay, so that's one thing we need to control when we do a printf exploit. We want to make sure we're reading the pointer from the place it actually is. And that's solely controlled by the number of percents. We want to control value written using pointer by number of characters output by printf. So percent C is one character. Something like A is one character. Percent 100U is 100 characters, which is something like that. And there's other things you could possibly use. Yeah. So this is about the value written. So percent C is, I'll write this, one character output, but uses two characters on the stack.
So the first part is for what value you're writing, and the second part is to make sure you line up
The first part is where you write, second part is, this part is where you write, this part is making sure you write the correct value. And this is, it prints out 100 characters, but uses, 6 characters on the stack, and I hope I didn't miscount. So any other questions on format string exploits? Confusion? Yeah.
So the percent from under view.
Yeah.
So depending on what value that integer had, for example, this example, it's 100. But if it was like a much larger number, then it would take more space on the stack as well than it was written. And that would.
Yeah. So that would affect where that would affect. So that would matter because you need to make your pointer be read from the correct place. Right. So it would. So it would take up more of slots in this buffer if you had a number which took up more space in this string than 100. If you had 200, it takes up the same amount of characters in the buffer. Other questions, comments? Okay. If we need to get back to this later. Okay, and I will do, so we talked about function pointers and exploits. So the difference between buffer and Stack Overflow is none, really, none. Full name is none except location of buffer, except maybe location of buffer. Okay, that's simple. So ASLR granularity. So what things have the same address? What things are loaded together? And have this slide, yeah. So on Linux, this is sort of our notional memory layout. And the key thing is that we need to load things that depend on each other. This is not the fully, but the key thing is that we set the location of the stack, for example. We can't make different parts of the stack be in different places, because that's not how the stack grows. When we set the location of a library we're loading, we can't load part of the library in one location and part in the other, because it expects to be loaded as a unit. When we get rid of this fixed constraint from our program, we still need to load the whole program as a unit because it has relative addresses for the program inside it. So the idea is, you know, stack needs to piece, you know, grows from fixed location from random location, but by fixed amounts. So if we know when, this means no one stack pointer can figure out all other stack pointers. So programs are loaded as one big chunk, is the other thing. So programs are loaded in one chunk, one piece of code and data. Random address for, so there's a random address for the whole chunk. Why am I looking at that when I have this in front of me? Whole chunk, but relative addresses chunk can't split. So we have relative addresses in our chunk of code, right? We have jumps that use a relative address. We typically aren't gonna fix those up. So we can't actually split up the chunk into multiple chunks. Which means that if we know one function address can figure out all others function addresses in program. And so if we know one function address in the program, we know where all the other functions are because they're just one big chunk of memory that's loaded together. And similarly, libraries are loaded in one chunk. That wasn't obvious from the slides, but they're loaded. We can choose randomly exactly where the library goes, but the whole library has relative addresses inside it. We can't actually split it up into little pieces and randomize each of those. So if we know one address in a library, we know all the addresses in the library. So this is a decision. So could try programs
query stacks, etc. pieces, but we don't. So there's nothing technically preventing us from doing that. Like, we could divide libraries into little pieces that are loaded separately. We could divide the stack into little pieces that are allocated separately, but we generally don't do that. But there's nothing technically preventing that. And that would be a better mitigation. Yeah?
So my question is, when you're shifting around these units on the stack, do you get like one random value and use that to determine where all the shifts go, or are you calculating a different random value for each?
OK, so on Linux, all these plus or minuses represent a different random value. And Linux also chooses a different random value each time it loads a library, which is as much as we can do. So it's doing the maximum you can do given these restrictions that we might have this chunk of code with relative addresses that we don't understand how to fix. Yeah. Yes, and therefore the addresses, exact addresses of each chunk, yeah. And that's generally going to be true. The question is just how big are the chunks? In the case of modern systems, typically they're pretty big. You could imagine that if you wanted to make, yeah, if you didn't mind having less relative addresses, you could like have each function be its own chunk in a library, for example. And it has some costs. Yeah. So this is partial ASLR without position independent executables. So I guess I should say, so if they aren't compiled that way, that won't be randomized. But the other things still can be. And this is sort of what Linux's implementation of ASLR does. Everything that it can randomize, it does. But that's not all addresses, depending on what the code does. So if our code doesn't have, if our code has fixed addresses, it can't randomize that part. Yeah.
So a program is loaded like each time, like if you're in a terminal, you type run something.exe, mm-hmm. That is when it's loaded.
Yes. Yeah. So a program. Yeah. So on Linux. Linux every time program is run or library is loaded. So Windows once per boot. Once per boot. So Linux just does this. Windows just does this once. Different choice. Linux does it every time, which is more typical and a bit better for security, because if you find out the address once, you don't know it for the rest of the time the computer is up. Yes.
Windows does something different. When they load it, don't they change some of the addresses as well?
Yeah. So Windows does more work to relocate it. They still actually have the restriction that the whole module needs to be together. So Windows just relaxes this restriction, basically. Yeah?
Is the whole randomization process just for security, or does it have another purpose?
The question is there a reason besides security why Linux is choosing these random addresses? And the answer is basically no. Basically no. It does make sure our position-independent code actually is position-independent, I suppose, which is good if you like want to know that libraries actually consistently work, but that's not really much of an advantage. Okay. Other questions on ASLR? Yeah?
Could you just explain what it means to be position-independent?
So what is position-independence? So if you remember, when we talked about things like virus code, we talked about different ways of referring to addresses. We had relative addresses, which were this instruction plus x bytes, that sort of thing. And we had absolute addresses, which were, you know, some fixed number. And machine code can have both. So if we have relative addresses only, machine code doesn't care where things are located. If we have absolute addresses, machine code does care, is position dependent. So that's that. So the position dependence means that it cares where it is, because that generally means it has absolute addresses. But as relative addresses, you can move it around and still have it work, and that's because it has, it uses where it is to compute where to get things.
So ASLR doesn't work with position dependent code.
So so unless you somehow fix up the code as you load it, like Windows does. So either you need to change the absolute addresses when you load the code, or it needs to be position independent. Other ASLR questions? Yeah.
Well, there's just no way of fixing it up, like when you don't compile it with the file.
So the question is, Linux has no way of fixing it when you don't compile, fixing up absolute addresses at runtime. So I'm not actually sure what the answer is to this. So it is definitely the case that you can't get GCC to generate something that is marked as position independent and contains absolute addresses. But there are rumors that there is code there's people who've claimed that there's support in the Linux loader for doing these fix-ups, but just no one uses it. Of course, support that no one uses probably is broken, so wouldn't recommend trying, but I don't actually know whether it's actually the case that Linux doesn't support it. If it did support it, it definitely would be slow. Because you'd need a separate copy of the code for every program, every instance of a program that's running. So if you type ls and ls worked this way, every time you ran ls, it would need to make a new copy of ls's code, which is ordinarily something that operating systems like Linux avoid. Other ASLR questions? Yeah.
Code with absolute addressing upon loading, but Windows can and does.
Yes. And a part of the reason why it can't fix it, the most important reason, is that most executables that would have addresses to fix just don't have the information in them to do it. Like GCC just doesn't generate that by default. You'd like need to do extra work to make that happen. Any other ASLR questions? Okay, so next topic on our list was baggy bounds. Apparently people were confused about everything. So let's start with sort of the basic motivation, which is we want to check pointer arithmetic. So when you do array I, we want to check array plus I or add array I. We want to make sure we didn't leave array. So we want to do this for all pointer arithmetic. This is what baggy bounds does. So it just checks that whenever you change pointers around, you don't leave the array that you're pointing to. So that's the basic idea. That's the most important thing to understand about what it's doing. So it's changing our code, the check pointer arithmetic, and if it fails check, we just crash. Rather than, for example, letting someone override a return address that's adjacent to our array. Or even read a stack canary that's adjacent to our array. So baggy bounds does some performance tricks to do this. So the first trick is that it allocates extra space for objects to make checking if we left object simpler. In particular, sizes are powers of two, which is simpler than having all possible sizes. So the only possible sizes are powers of two. That simplifies this, did we leave the object check? And it allocates objects at addresses that are multiples of size to also simplify check. So it does that, this trick where it has the addresses and a multiple of the size to simplify the checks. So those are two big performance tricks that they did. So you could have a system which should work, which didn't do those tricks, and those exist, they'd just be slower. So that's not actually essential to that technique. So the big thing they needed is a way to look up start of objects. So the idea is, left array is start of array equals start of array I. That's what they're checking on the pointer arithmetic. And the baggy bounds choice for this is a giant lookup table for every part of memory. So they have an entering lookup table for everything in memory about where the start of the object that contains that memory is. There are other choices they could use, but that's what they did. This is the actually important parts. This is the sort of functional parts of what they're doing. So they're checking pointer arithmetic, making sure you don't let a pointer go outside of the bounds of an array, even for a read. And they do this extra stuff about powers of two, which is just about making those checks faster. And this deals with buffer overflows because you can't get out of the bounds of an array this way. You can't go into another object space at all. We just will stop the program from ever doing that. So I assume people maybe still have questions about baggy bounds, given a level of confusion about it. No, maybe. Yeah.
So you have the giant lookup table for like where the memory starts, and does it also say like how long?
So the question is, does the lookup table say how long? So, so it doesn't say the length explicitly, but could scan table to see when object changes. So you could just scan ahead in the table to see when you get to the next object. See when your starting location changes to something else, then you're in a different object. That's where the end of the object is. Yeah. I guess it doesn't need to say length explicitly. The baggy bounds trick is they only store the length. And they know the start because they have this rule that they start in multiples of n. Multiples of the size. But the basic technique doesn't conceptually really rely on storing the length. They're just checking that the starting point is the same, meaning it's the same array. Other questions? Okay, so let's go on to our remaining topics. Oh, I answered this above. Yeah, so use after free. How do use after free vulnerabilities work generally? So the basic idea of a use after free, I'm on the wrong screen, vulnerability is that is that you rely on a coincidence happening, that when you free something, Okay, maybe I don't have a picture for this. Oh, I do, okay. That when you free something, when you free this object foo, that you still have a pointer to, even though it's deleted. This is the sort of use after free bug, that when we allocate something else, it might end up in the same place. And this is just because malloc and new implementations want to be efficient. They don't want to, they want to just give back memory that's easiest to find. It's easy to find something that was just freed. So they'll give you back to something, this foo to you, the same pointer, as if it's a bar. And that means that you get to control all the values in foo. And that can include things like pointers to function pointers, or pointers to data pointers. And so all the same sorts of things you do with a buffer overflow work in this case. But rather than overflowing a buffer to change foo, you just allocated a new object where foo is supposed to be. So the basic idea is dangling pointer, so you know, up to deleted object. So we have the object, change deleted object by changing newly allocated object. It just happened to be allocated at same address. So you need to arrange for this coincidence to happen, but that's commonly how allocators work. They'll return similar addresses to what they returned before. And you can just set the deleted object by manipulating your new object. Yeah. So flexibility, yeah. So need new object type to let you change what you want. So whether this is hard or not depends on what the new object type. So easy if new object type is string, for example. If it's a string, you could probably change anything, right? So that's the easy case, and that's usually what attackers go for. But it's harder if, you know, if it's a more structured type, you know, like binary tree node, let's say. Then you might have a lot less control. So in the example we went through, the Chrome use after free example, attacker had lots of choices for new object type, because the attacker was just writing JavaScript that made things that allocated things, which caused C++ objects to be allocated. So they had this giant library of object types. And often you are in situations like that, where you have a giant library of things you can use. If it's not something like JavaScript, let's say you have a server where you send commands, so you do something which makes there be a dangling pointer, then you just choose what command to send, and you might have lots and lots of choices. Yeah.
If we can write our own object, then why do we care about changing previous function pointers if we can just write our own thing to point to whatever we want to in the first place?
So the reason you might be able to write your own object is, let's say it's a string. Like, you can put any value in the string, but that doesn't let you actually execute any code. So we're relying on change what you want. And get it misinterpreted. The key part is that it's going to be misinterpreted. Like, we might have total control over the contents of the objects, but we don't get to make it be interpreted as a function pointer. That's what the pointer to the other type of which thinks it's the wrong type, is going to do for us. So the key idea is that our new object's going to be interpreted as something else. Yeah?
I thought the case in the Chrome as well was like, we basically had complete control over code, but then that allowed us to get access to parts of Chrome that are supposed to be sampling.
So I gave multiple Chrome exploit examples, but for the use after free based one, we had complete control of our code, yes, which we broke out of the sort of what JavaScript is supposed to be allowed to do.
Right.
So basically we could write JavaScript code which executed the machine code, which we're not supposed to be able to do. That was what the exploit was. So we could write an arbitrary JavaScript program, but JavaScript programs aren't supposed to be able to say open a file on your machine.
But it's more than just like misinterpreting.
Yes, but well, the cause of the exploit was that something that our JavaScript code wrote was misinterpreted as a function pointer. When our JavaScript code should never ever be able to write something that's interpreted as just a function pointer. Even if we can write any value to a buffer, let's say. Okay. Yeah.
So, use after free can lead to using ROP as a strategy?
Yes. So, in the case of modern exploits, if you find a use after free vulnerability, probably write X or execute is enabled on the system. So no matter what you can write to, it's not executable. So you need to use something like ROP to run code. Typical modern exploit on security aware software, like e.g. a web browser, needs to have information leak to defeat ASLR. This is step, and return-oriented programming or to defeat write X or execute. These are mandatory steps in addition to the normal vulnerability stuff because of those mitigations. They're doable and commonly done, but they're extra steps, which are a significant amount of extra effort. Especially compared to stack smashing, which is not trivial, but is relatively trivial compared to making this use after free vulnerability work despite write X or execute in the ASLR. Yeah.
Can you give some examples of common information leaks?
So for example, the way the Chrome use after free exploit got an information leak is. Was by using the use after free exploit. They found some type which would print out pointers from the raw from the original object or a way that the misinterpreted object would print out pointers from some other object, and they got some pointer values to be printed out that way. That would be a common example of an information leak. Other cases are if you have an out of bounds buffer read, if you can get something to think it has to. I have to read 1,000 characters out of 100 character buffer. That might read some pointers for you. Yeah.
The basic idea of a use after free only works if the newly allocated object is not initialized, right?
So the question is: the basic idea of use after free only works if the newly allocated object is not initialized. No. So in the case where we just want to replace a function pointer in the old object, we don't care that the newly allocated object is completely initialized. In the case where you want to use this method to find out a pointer, if we can have a pointer be in our newly allocated object and use the old object type to print out that pointer, that's enough. Yeah. So the setup is that the code has a bug where it frees an object, installs a pointer to it, and the attacker arranges just for a new object to be created. So if it's initialized, it gets set to, its fields get set to some value, and the attacker just looks at what those fields would be when interpreted as a foo instead of a bar, and tries to make sure that's useful. Useful ideally would mean that there will be a function pointer there that will just run the attacker's code. Less ideally, it might mean that there's a data element there, which is a pointer in bar that will be printed out by foo or something like that. But you just, you look for what your option, what type is allocated, and you just figure out what can I control in this bar. And maybe you can't control enough to do anything useful, or maybe you can. But presumably some of this data that the attacker gets to decide because they're using the program and the bar is being allocated because of their request. Yeah.
So this is hard to use, but it's possible to use when not writing something, but when using the program that's already made, like an address book, if you delete a person out of it, but keep some of the reference to them.
Yeah, so this is, that's the typical form of it, is that you somehow make the program delete something without getting rid of all the references to it. That's what this bug is. And the way you exploit it is you send the commands that cause that situation to happen, which is usually some under-tested part of the code, right? Because you probably would notice a crash if that happened often. And then you send other commands to create things. So in like an address book application, you want to create new entries after you arrange for this to happen in the hopes of the new entries being where the old entry was that still has a pointer from somewhere, like a reference to friends of person, but not in the main index. Okay, so any other topics that I have completely missed in our last 7 minutes or so? Yeah.
A quick review of double freeze.
So double freeze. So the key idea of double freeze is that this makes a linked list cyclic if the free implementation doesn't check and it uses linked lists. So that's the key idea. So it makes a cyclic linked list, assuming the free implementation isn't careful and uses linked lists. And that means malloc returns an object twice. Now that's the biggest problem. So malloc returning an object twice is already a problem because that's essentially the use after free problem. But this is more directly exploitable. That's what a problem already. So we could like have these objects misinterpreted as each other. The other issue is that free will use pointers in free space entry at same location as object. So free thinks, oh, this is an entry on my linked list, even though it returned it as something from free. Okay. I've currently been not showing you the notes I've been typing up. Free, in this case, will allocate an object that also has pointers that free thinks it's using. And this is this is part of our problem, is that because we have this cycle on our linked list, that we're gonna end up with this situation where we return an allocated object that happens to also be part of our linked list. So if you change the object, you change the linked list. And that lets you decide a memory location and write a pointer there. Yeah.
Okay, so because free still thinks it's using those pointers,
yeah,
then you can write the object to use those pointers to get any value to write anywhere you want.
Yeah, so you can get change object, change pointers free will write to. So you can, yeah. So if you change the object, you can change the pointers to writes to, which means that you're going to get a case where you can write anywhere you want. Yeah?
Has the malloc implementation in Linux actually do it?
So the question is, does the malloc implementation in Linux do it? So most current malloc free, I think pretty much, I guess almost all current malloc free explicitly check for double frees. They just check, is this already on my list of free things? Just because it's relatively fast to check, basically. And also a relatively common error that programmers make. Okay. Other topics that we're missing or questions on prior topics? Yeah. So exam cumulative? So basically no. So this is stack smashing to present. Only, but you probably should read it, be able to read assembly. Yeah. There will be some questions, yeah, which are similar to things in the homework, yes.
So we'll have to, like, match that.
We're going to make things which are not as hard to grade as that, but you may need to answer questions which are things you would need to know to do that. And I think probably more than last time we'll have more questions which are like, what would be a value compute to do some exploit? Not necessarily one we've done on the homework, but yeah. How would you overwrite this pointer? You know, where is that in this buffer, et cetera? Yeah.
So is there going to be less of the select all that apply questions and more specific questions like that?
Yes, there will still be some select all that apply questions. But we had just had less topics which lend themselves to that sort of coverage. We had some, like all the mitigations kind of lend themselves to that sort of, you should know when a mitigation does something, when it doesn't. Okay, other questions? Yeah?
What do you mean by stack smashing present
only? Stack smashing what? Stack smashing, which is what you did in over. To last week's lecture. Sorry, this is chronology in the schedule. Okay, so that's all I have. So exam is Wednesday. There is a homework assignment that will be released on Friday, which I'm sure you will all forget, but there is. And I will correct the error in my slide on the vtable overwrite, which we discovered I had the wrong register. And there are some last chance office hours. If you still have questions, please study. If you haven't handed in a format, please work on that. And I'm disappointed I haven't seen more of those people in office hours. But. Okay.
Thank you.